This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear how imprisoned mom Ann Simmons found out about her daughter's death.
I got called to the chaplain's office, and then my 18-year-old son had to do the worst thing he ever had to do in his life. Tell me that my baby girl was gone.
Ryan Denham reports on the case of 8-year-old Rika Rountree. Plus, the group Stand Up for Social Justice has been demonstrating every month for the last 3 years in Bloomington Normal. Eric Stock talks to them about protest as lifestyle and the difference they hope to make. The Illinois Politics Roundtable dives into ethics reform measures that might advance in Springfield, and we'll have a report on electric car range anxiety and a move to address it along a major U.S. interstate. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It has been 3 years since the group Stand Up for Social Justice staged its first rally in Bloomington. The grassroots advocacy group has made it a monthly effort. Linda Unterman and Sarah Holthaus-Wiedmeyer are two of the organizers. Unterman tells WGLT's Eric Stock the progressive movement needed a voice in Bloomington Normal after Donald Trump was elected president.
After the election in 2016, we felt that there was a need possibly for a demonstration of a progressive voice in Bloomington Normal. And so we decided to start these vigils on the every second Tuesday on various subjects that we thought would come up that needed attention.
Did you decide at the beginning that this would be a monthly thing, or did that sort of happen organically?
We pretty much decided that it would be monthly, and we chose Tuesdays because that's traditionally a day of election, and elections do matter.
So you're referring to the 2016 election, of course, when President Trump won. Why did you feel at that point that there needed to be a progressive voice? Did you feel that that voice wasn't being represented in Washington or at the state level or at the local level?
We've mostly addressed problems at the national level, although we have done some state issues also. We felt that the rhetoric in the campaign of President Trump's campaign would direct him towards having issues that were not in the progressive voice.
And Sarah, as someone who's helped promote these events through social media and other means, how do you get people involved?
Well, actually, it's kind of easy. We have a lot of progressives in this community who share the same concerns as we do. As Linda mentioned, the campaign brought a lot of rhetoric and hate and divisiveness among individuals. So we felt that this would be a good way for people to voice their concerns. And when we do this, we don't do it just independently. We ask others what their concerns are, what's pressing them this month, and we ask for ideas so we can come upon the subject matter to choose from.
These vigils cover a lot of events in the news: healthcare, immigration, sexual violence, climate change. How do you decide what event to focus on each month, and are there certain topics that have proven to be more impactful than others?
Almost 40% of our vigils have been either on healthcare or various aspects of immigration, but others that have been covered, as you mentioned, have been climate change or the water crisis continuing in Flint, LGBT rights. A variety of topics. And what we try and do is gauge what will be important or in the news the week after we do the planning. So we try and guess what will be important while we are doing our vigil. And we use that as a basis for our choice.
quite often it's too easy to find, you know, cherry pick subjects that are easy pickings and easy to do. What we try to do is what's going to be important in 2 weeks to us. What's coming down the mainstream of Congress? What are they up to? What is POTUS up to? What are they about to do? Are they going to, you know, kick the trans out of the military? Are they going to rescind DACA's, our promise to DACA? Those are things that we're concerned about. So we see the timelines. We see when they're in session, when they're on recess, and that's when we find our topic.
So these vigils are staged in a highly visible area with intent, of course, along a state highway in front of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. You get lots of traffic going by. Cars pass. They might honk in support. Maybe they show their displeasure. But they only see it for a few seconds. Then they go on their way. So how do you know that you're making any difference?
That's a good question.
Linda?
One way we think we're making a difference is by comments of our supporters, the people that are on the ground. And occasionally we'll say, you know, well, is this vigil still relevant to you? You know, what we should be doing? And universally, our supporters are saying, oh, please don't stop. Please don't stop. We need these. It's so important for you to be there once a month where we can count on you. So we can come once a month and sort of gain our strength, meet with others in the progressive movement. So we feel we're making a difference with our supporters. As far as people that aren't showing up, we get a number of honks usually for our ideas of the vigil. And I think for the most part, those are positive ones. Occasionally we'll get a gesture that is not positive, but for the most part, they are positive. And it's true, we do hold our vigil at a visible spot for a reason, and we hold it at a good time, 5:30 to 6, where we think it's most possible to get people perhaps on their way home after work so that we get a good traffic flow.
So you are making a difference with your supporters, as you say. As you know, Americans have become increasingly dug in on what they believe and in some respects, who they're even willing to listen to. How do you break through that when, again, you have just a very short amount of time, some fleeting seconds to catch their attention?
Well, in addition to that fleeting time, as you call it, we do mention to our supporters that it's important for us to be able to talk to people, perhaps, that do not totally share our point of view. In a way that they'll listen. That means that we have to respectfully listen to other people and take their comments as being true for them. Mm-hmm. And it's so important that we be able to not take a partisan view and talk to other people as if we are respecting their views, so we can talk to them and possibly influence them in the future.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Linda Unterman and Sarah Holthaus-Wiedemeyer with the group Stand Up for Social Justice, which is marking 3 years of monthly rallies the group has been staging in Bloomington. So, Linda, what does the group do in the way of advocacy beyond this, perhaps talking to legislators, either at the local, state, or national level, or moving this beyond to simply a public dialogue and moving it toward action?
We mention always that if we just stand here with our signs, we're not doing enough. We need to reach out to, as you mentioned, to our legislators. And what we do usually is hand out a flyer at the end of the vigil with phone numbers for our legislators and with perhaps the bill number that they need to mention. Mm-hmm. And urge phone calls. And I think by all means, I think our supporters want those hints about who to call, and I think they are making the calls in trying to influence them.
Now, the group certainly hasn't run out of things to talk about and issues on which to advocate. However, when you have a group that is staging these vigils all the time on a regular basis, as you are, referring to a whole myriad of issues as a crisis or a potential crisis that has to be addressed, you know, we in our business hear so much about news fatigue, that people become stressed out and they tune out. Do you fear that you're running the risk of watering down your own message, and are people eventually going to tune out?
I guess we hope not. There's no way that people in the general audience are going to tell us perhaps that they're fatigued, but we are certainly not seeing a continued interest among our supporters. We had a core group of 30 or so at every vigil, and it's been as high as 200. So we're still seeing people come to the vigils and enthusiastically participate.
And do you feel that you're making a difference, and in what way?
I definitely feel we're making a difference with our supporters. As I mentioned, occasionally we'll ask them, you know, is this worth it? Should we continue? And they always say, please continue. We need you to be there to sort of buoy up our confidence. And we've mentioned to them that, or they mentioned to us, that sometimes in this relatively conservative community, sometimes it's difficult to be able to speak our views openly in even family groups or work groups. And so this gives everyone an opportunity to voice their views, find some commonality with other people, make friends. And so the social aspect of it is important also, I think.
So the group has indicated they want to keep on going. Do you anticipate this will go on indefinitely? Is there a certain benchmark that you're looking for where you think, okay, our group has done its job and let's move on, or perhaps move on into other areas of advocacy?
Well, we're certainly carry on to the next election. And I think as that approaches, we'll have to have some dialogue about, as you say, where we go from here. We'll just have to take it on at that point. I don't know. It's a lot of work to stage these once a month, and we'll have to see if people want to keep going.
But that leads us to the subject of building leaders in our community, especially in our progressive community. And Linda and I firmly believe in handing the reins over to others. So as people present themselves and if they wish to participate, we let them work as well, as much as they want. And with that said, you know, they're able to go ahead and at times, like, say, the immigrant situation, I kind of handed it over to people who really knew what they were doing. Although I, you know, oversaw it and promoted it and everything, I appreciated that they got the speakers, they got the people coming, and they were able to get the word out. And actually, there was like 247 people attended that event. I was just shocked because it meant a lot to a lot of people in this community. And for those people to come out, a lot of them were very fearful because we did not have a safe city in either of our towns.
And on the issue of immigration, both police in Bloomington and Normal have indicated that their policies reflect what is mandated in the Illinois Trust Act. And the issue has sort of gone away a little bit. Do you feel that the issue is still on the forefront? Is there still concern? Do you feel that this has been addressed to some degree?
I think definitely there still is concern. I think one of the reasons that it's not in the forefront all the time, and why we have had that issue relatively recently in our vigils, but we don't get the attendance of 200 people, and part of that reason mm-hmm. is fear. Many of these people in our cities that are undocumented are fearful that they, if they show up at a vigil like this, the authorities might take notice of who is there and would target them. So I think people are sort of staying under the radar as much as possible, possibly, and thus don't want to be as public as they used to be. But I think the need is still there for us to have safe cities.
And you had indicated that the next election, the 2020 election, is a focal point for this group. However, the group is also nonpartisan. So how do you keep those two things separate, advocating for causes without advocating for candidates or parties?
It's difficult.
It's a careful
it's,
dance.
It's very difficult when most people see one side of the road being more progressive than the other. But we're very careful not to mention names of the candidates. we figure that helps. And we always encourage people to support their candidates or their legislators, whoever they might be. So we try and walk that line very carefully, especially since some of the groups that support us, such as Not in Our Town or the YWCA or the Unitarian Church, many of those groups have people in them, members that are of both parties. So we don't want to alienate anyone from any of those groups, too.
That's Linda Unterman and Sarah Holthaus-Wiedmeyer of Stand Up for Social Justice with WGLT's Eric Stock. The group will move its monthly vigils to the noon hour for the winter months, starting in December.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in a few minutes, the Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at ethics reform proposals bubbling up from the murky cauldron in Springfield. The murder trial begins today for Cynthia Baker of Normal. She's accused of chronically abusing and ultimately killing her boyfriend's daughter, 8-year-old Rika Roundtree, earlier this year. In this encore story, WGLT's Ryan Denham and correspondent Edith Brady Lunny report on Rika's life and death and the gaps it exposed in the state's child welfare system.
When a doctor began the autopsy of an 8-year-old Bloomington Normal girl in January, he started by counting the scars on her body. There were 67 marks signaling extensive abuse, but it was the internal injuries to the abdomen that killed the girl. Her name is Rika Roundtree. The girlfriend of Rika's father goes on trial this week for murder. Cynthia Baker allegedly kicked Rika in the stomach, causing those internal injuries that slowly killed her.
Everybody failed her. I failed her.
That's Rika's mother, Ann Simmons. While Baker is the one facing trial, Simmons says there were many others who were aware of the abuse and failed to stop it.
The dragging her through the house, the smashing her face into the wall, the torture that she went through is all the stuff that I tried to tell them that she was going through and nobody would listen to me.
Rika was one of over 100 children who've died in the past year while involved in some way with the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS. The deaths have prompted an overhaul of the state agency that cares for children. In Rika's case, the key question is why authorities in 2016 sent Rika to live with her father in Baker, a woman who WGLT has learned was twice before placed on a list of known child abusers. Simmons largely blames DCFS. We spoke to her in prison in Decatur, where she's finishing a 2.5-year prison sentence in a forgery case and for failing to complete the terms of her probation on an aggravated DUI.
Your only position in this world is to protect our children when the parents can't. That's your position, is to pick up where we fall short and try to keep us together. I'm not sure where they dropped the ball at with giving a care about our kids, but they did.
DCFS faces scrutiny for how rarely it removes children from their home. Illinois actually has the lowest foster care entry rate in the U.S. And a study commissioned earlier this year after a string of child deaths, including Rika's, found that DCFS staff don't feel empowered to recommend removal, even when they feel it's warranted. Before all this, before she was a number or a poster child for DCFS reforms, Simmons says that Rika was an independent kid with a big imagination, especially with her dolls.
So I became a grandma of all the little doll babies, and she would go to like yard sales, and we'd pick up like strollers and car seats and clothes and Pampers at the store. She needed baby bottles, all that stuff.
Rika was exactly the kind of kid who needed protection. Her family has a history of domestic violence and substance abuse. Rika's parents, Simmons and Richard Roundtree, split up in 2015 and later divorced. That family fractured even further in 2016 when Rika was still living with her mother. Police raided her mother's home and arrested Simmons on drug charges. Rika went to live with her father and his girlfriend, Cynthia Baker. By the middle of 2017, court and police records show Rika was raising concerns about Baker. Simmons says that her daughter was visibly fearful around Baker. DCFS investigated Baker for allegedly hitting Rika with a belt, but found no credible evidence of abuse. Simmons says this is when Rika's behavior started to change.
She was just different. She was more reserved. She was really cautious about a lot of stuff, whereas before she was carefree. She ran the house. She was a princess. She did what she wanted to do.
In April 2018, during a visit at Rika's school, Simmons says she was shocked to see her daughter with a split lip, black eye, broken tooth, scars on her neck, and her hair cut really short. When DCFS investigated, Rika explained away her injuries as clumsy accidents at home. DCFS says Rika denied anyone was hurting her in the home or that she was fearful of anyone. DCFS labeled any claims of abuse as unfounded. 4 months later, in October of 2018, Simmons says her ex-husband had made it clear he was done with Rika.
He was telling me that I need to find a knight in shining armor to save Rika because he didn't want nothing to do with her. He didn't want to pay child support. He didn't want visits. He didn't want to be her father. He just wanted her to be adopted out so that he didn't have any obligation to her.
Around this time, the animosity at home between Baker and Rika worsened. Authorities say the staff at Rika's school provided her with a coat, a gesture that authorities said sparked an irate response from Baker. She allegedly accused the school's staff of favoring Rika over Baker's own daughter. After the coat incident, prosecutors say Rika arrived at school in December 2018 with two black eyes. School staff notified DCFS. Prosecutors say Baker became angry with school officials for doing that. She claimed Rika was just clumsy and had given herself the black eyes. Rika said she hurt herself by falling on some toys. And so, for the third time in 16 months, a DCFS investigation of Richard and Baker determined any claims of abuse to be unfounded. Baker pulled her daughter and Rika from the school and enrolled them at Prairieland Elementary instead. Simmons was continuing her custody fight for Rika. But a month later, in January of 2019, a judge determined Simmons was not making enough progress on the terms of her probation. He sentenced her to 2.5 years in prison for not completing probation and for a separate forgery case. He said her efforts to get back on track were too little, too late. By then, it was also too late for Rika. On January 26, 2019, Rika became unresponsive after several days of belly pain. An ambulance took Rika to Advocate Broman Hospital. She had a large bruise on her abdomen and was transferred to Peoria. She went into surgery for internal injuries but died on the operating table. A forensic pathologist determined Rika died from peritonitis caused by blunt force injury. Simmons was just over 2 weeks into her prison sentence.
I got called to the chaplain's office. And they called my 18-year-old son, and my 18-year-old son had to do the worst thing he ever had to do in his life. And he had to tell me that my baby girl was gone. She wasn't coming back.
During a 3-month investigation of Richard Roundtree and Cynthia Baker, investigators discovered cell phone videos allegedly documenting Baker's ongoing abuse of Rika. Prosecutors charged Baker with murder and aggravated domestic battery. The state removed 4 other children living in their home, including 2 teenagers who prosecutors said witnessed and experienced significant abuse themselves. DCFS says that Baker and Richard were both indicted for multiple allegations of abuse and neglect related to Rika's death, meaning DCFS believes they were responsible for the injury. It wasn't the first time that Baker was indicated for abuse. According to court records obtained by WGLT, Baker was found to have caused injuries to his stepchild in 2002 and her own daughter in 2012. Baker's murder trial is set to begin Tuesday. One of her attorneys, Brendan Bukowski, said in a statement she's innocent and they look forward to a jury hearing her case. It's unclear if Rika's father, Richard Roundtree, could also face criminal charges in her death. He hasn't so far. Here's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner.
That is part of that whole investigation. We certainly work with DCFS, but we're also working with the state's attorney's office on that. And again, we're cautious as we move through this to make sure that we have, if we do have a case, that we can certainly bring that to a successful prosecution.
As Rika's death plays out in the criminal justice system, lawmakers hold it up as an example of why DCFS needs a major overhaul. Lawmakers point to the 100 or so children who die every year while under DCFS care of some kind. The agency's acting inspector general says that figure hasn't changed since 2013, showing Illinois is failing to improve. She notes DCFS's failure to complete thorough and timely investigations, a lack of clinical supervision of staff who are making life-altering decisions for families, and poor follow-through of past inspector general recommendations for how to fix known problems. In a recent memo to lawmakers, the inspector general wrote, "Management must support its investigators by giving them needed resources. Investigative shortcuts occur when investigators are overburdened." Rika's mother, Ann Simmons, questions why DCFS seemingly believed Rika's own explanations for her injuries. Simmons says DCFS could have done more to make Rika feel safe and be honest.
I said, if y'all go and check on her, pull her out of that place, take her somewhere safe and talk to her, she'll be honest with y'all. I said, at this point, I told them exactly what was going on. I said, they're putting the fear of God in my child. She gonna say whatever they tell her to say because y'all keep leaving her there.
After the July 2017 allegations involving the belt, Simmons says two DCFS investigators had only a brief 5-minute conversation with Rika at a bus stop outside the McLean County Courthouse.
And that was it. And it was over with. It was done.
This issue came up during a May 2019 hearing in Springfield when the House Adoption and Child Welfare Committee asked DCFS leadership about a string of recent child deaths, including Rika's. Here's State Representative Ann Moeller, a Democrat from Elgin, asking a staffer about Rika's case.
I look at Rika Roundtree, who went to school several times with obvious signs of abuse and black eyes, broken, missing teeth, and was, told teachers, told the investigators that, she had run into appliances at home or, fell on her toys or whatnot. That's not being used to determine whether or not there's abuse, correct? I would hope. You tell me.
So when we have children and we talk to children, one of the things that we do, we listen to them, we listen to what they want to tell us, we ask them questions to try and specify, dates and time as best we can, because we're talking to a child, so it's a little bit different than talking with an adult. One of the other things that we do is that we ask that person, that child, is there somebody you feel safe with or somebody that makes you feel safe, so that we can use that person as a collateral and that we can go talk to that person. We also hope to utilize our medical providers so that when there are situations that we can go in and we can say, here's what we have. Does this appear plausible? Is this possible that it could have happened this way? So there's a lot that goes into a finding. Yes, we do listen to what the child says, but that's only a portion of what we listen to when we're making our decisions.
With Rika's recurring injuries, why wasn't she removed from the home and placed in foster care? One reason is that Illinois has largely moved away from family separations as a practice. Doris Houston is director of ISU's Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. She's a former DCFS Child Welfare Administrator. She says decades ago, as many as 50,000 children were in foster care. Now it's down to around 17,000.
It's a good thing, but if we are going that route, we have to make sure there are the services available, readily available for families. Our society is facing some really complex problems.
A study this year from Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago found that some DCFS workers face pressure to keep families together, even after evidence of abuse or neglect. Houston says the foster system cannot handle many of the cases.
The flip side, though, is we don't always have enough foster parents and foster homes to adequately serve the needs of children. And every foster home isn't equipped for every foster child.
DCFS is still investigating Rika's death. The agency says it's committed to understanding exactly what happened in the case and being fully transparent with the public. DCFS says it's working closely with the new Pritzker administration to review its practices, policies, and procedures to fully live up to its mission to protect vulnerable children in Illinois. This year's state budget includes a $130 million budget increase for DCFS, and the agency plans to hire hundreds of new employees. Here's Doris Houston again from ISU.
I really look at the increases that have occurred this year as absolutely as essential to really get the agency back on its footing in terms of hiring, in terms of resources, even things we don't think of like data management. All of those kinds of things really take resources.
Ann Simmons, Rika's mother, is scheduled to be released from Decatur Correctional Center in December. First thing on her to-do list is finding Rika's remains. She was cremated, but Simmons says no memorial service was held. Simmons also has four sons. She says she wants to try and regain custody of her 12-year-old. She says she wants to share her story.
My daughter should have not have ever died. It should have never been this way. Something has to happen from the beginning, so that the ends don't be like this.
Simmons says she hopes to become an advocate for fixing a system she feels let her daughter down, so medical examiners don't have to count the abuse scars on the bodies of other little girls and boys. I'm Ryan Denham reporting with WGLT correspondent Edith Brady Lunny.
Since this story originally aired last month, Cynthia Baker's attorneys have disclosed a possible alternative explanation for how Rika was injured. They say her internal injuries could have been caused by a seatbelt when her father reportedly slammed on the brakes while driving in a construction zone near Chicago. That theory and more are expected to be dissected at Baker's trial starting this week. Jury selection began this morning.
The most important voice on WGLT might be yours.
I'm Carolyn Moon. I live in Hudson, Illinois.
When you add your voice as a financial contributor, we listen. Listeners tell us they value NPR and WGLT on air and online, and you know why your money is important.
This stuff doesn't come free. I really wanted to support the thing that I want to be around and make my community better.
Add your voice now.
I'm Carolyn Moon. Join me and contribute at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, performing Heroes and Villains at 7:30 on Friday, November 15th at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, with a special tribute to the U.S. Armed Forces. Details at ilsymphony.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, how several states are tackling the lack of electric car infrastructure along a major interstate. An ethics scandal continues to simmer in Springfield, with federal bribery charges filed against a state senator and a large but as yet unpublic investigation into lobbying activities in the state capitol. The Illinois Politics Roundtable looks ahead at what might emerge as new laws to address the present situation. Sean Crawford moderates the panel, composed of analyst Charlie Wheeler, IPR State House editor Brian Mackey, and reporter Jamie Monks from the Chicago Tribune. Monks says Governor J.B. Pritzker is already talking about reforms.
Governor Pritzker has said that he really wants a lobbyist disclosure to be one of the first steps in addressing some of these allegations that we've seen, specifically with Representative Luis Arroyo. But in addition to that, the governor is also calling for a more comprehensive reform package. So it's looking like the lobbyist disclosure and, creating more transparency around that is something immediate that he would like lawmakers to take up. But then looking ahead to the spring, something bigger, more substantial to come. That's what he's pushing for.
Has he talked about what he wants to see that's more substantial, what he would be pushing for in a few months?
You know, we haven't seen a real specific proposal on that yet. At the same time, you have the Democratic legislative leaders talking about reform proposals as well. Last week, Senate President John Cullerton said that he wanted to look at convening a joint panel, Senate and House panel, where they would look at some larger ethics reforms as well, which is something that they did in the aftermath of the Blagojevich scandal. There's a lot of push for reform, and I think a lot of people are kind of envisioning something more comprehensive beyond some of these things that address allegations that have come out recently. But as far as specifics and what that might look like next year, we don't have a lot of that right yet.
And Brian, going into an election year, I'm assuming voting for some ethics changes could be an easy sell. I guess it depends on what they are.
Yeah, I mean, who likes lobbyists out there in the general public? I mean, I think those of us who work here in the building understand that, you know, the word lobbyist, when it's used in the public, people think of, you know, tobacco lobbyists or the oil companies and gambling interests who are just spread money around while lighting up cigars with $100 bills sort of thing. There are a lot of other lobbyists who work in this building for poor children, for people who have been victims of crimes, for elderly and disabled people. So, I mean, they're all different kinds of lobbyists, and there is some concern that painting them with this broad brush, creating these new disclosure requirements, could hurt especially some of the more independent and not huge moneyed lobbyists. I think it's also interesting that we're talking about, or the governor is talking about cracking down on lobbyists, when in fact it was a lawmaker, not a lobbyist, who was arrested and accused of trying to bribe another lawmaker last week. So in one sense, there's a bit of misdirection at play here. And we heard, and I think we'll talk about a little later, the House Republicans coming forward with their own ethics package that, as opposed to what the governor has been talking about, would actually target lawmaker behavior, not necessarily just lobbyist behavior.
And Brian, I think a lot of people probably get a bit confused when they hear, Representative Arroyo was a lobbyist. I mean, they're thinking, well, wait a minute, what's that all about? Can you kind of explain that dual role that he was playing there?
Yeah, that is unusual but not unheard of in Illinois. There are a number of these legislators, both at the state and at the local level, who are registered lobbyists for the other type of government. So he was registered in the city of Chicago to lobby the city council for interests that, and Jamie knows a lot more about this from reporting this week, but sweepstakes machines, which are maybe or maybe not a form of video gambling, depending. We can come back to that particular breakdown of how that works. But so he is lobbying the city council in Chicago. There's Cook County Commissioner Larry Suffredin comes to mind, who is, like I said, he's a county commissioner in Cook County. He has long been a state house lobbyist for other interests. Even people like Senate President John Cullerton himself has been a registered lobbyist with the city of Chicago. Now, some people will say their Chicago lobbying law is so broad that if you want to help someone with sort of routine bureaucracy, getting a building permit or something like that, it's safer to register as a lobbyist. They're not necessarily advocating for, you know, policy changes as lobbyists. But, that is the sort of blurring you have of these lines and what, you know, lawmakers still say is a citizen legislature. And so, you know, people got to eat, I guess, the, you know, 70 something thousand dollar salary that most of them make plus, can be supplemented with his outside income. And so some of them have chosen to do that through lobbying and trying to influence government.
I know, Charlie, you've watched a lot of this action through the years, and you've seen probably a lot of, as what Brian was saying, blurring of lines. Is this a good idea, what the governor's talking about, at least on its face?
To have elected officials mm-hmm. not lobbying other areas of government?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it is. Now, I would draw the distinction between someone like Mayor Lightfoot saying, I want the General Assembly to do X, Y, or Z, which is legitimate interaction among governments, as opposed to Charlie Wheeler, who's a member of the legislature, getting paid, $10,000 to go and lobby the city of Chicago to do X, Y, or Z. I think the distinction is, if you're advocating for a policy change at another government level and you're a government elected official at some other level of government, I think that's okay as long as there's no money involved.
Now, Jamie, of course, Republicans, as was mentioned earlier, have come out with their own package that they want to see passed. Of course, they have one big problem, and that is they don't hold majorities in the legislature, and it's going to be harder for them to move anything through on their own. I know they're aware of that, but are there some things in there that seem like they might have a bit of bipartisan agreement?
You know, potentially, one of the things that was raised in keeping on this lobbying track here that we're talking about was having a statewide database that it sounds like could be run through the Secretary of State's office, where, you know, every lobbyist for local governments, for state governments, you could go and you could find information in the same place. You've also, there was kind of a larger package that House Republicans put out there where they want to revise the statements of economic interests, have some more details there. So a number of things that they are proposing, also banning members of the General Assembly, spouses and immediate family members from doing paid lobbying work with local government units. So, you know, some of these things are proposals that have come up over the years and haven't gone anywhere. I think that there is a feeling that something needs to be done on both sides of the aisle. But, you know, we haven't heard anything really specifically from Democratic leaders that they are planning on taking up these proposals that the Republicans have put out yet. You know, so we've got kind of everybody is sort of working on their own proposal, floating their own proposal. And I think it's a big question what actually gets done and when it gets done.
And Charlie, what is the public, you think? What was the public's view of this type of stuff? Do they really, you know, every time I talk to somebody about ethics legislation or they're trying to do this at the Capitol, people just shake their head and like they'll find a way around it. You know, they don't buy into the fact that anybody's truly cleaning up government. Does it sell to the public if they're able to pass this type of stuff, even if it's needed, even if it's a good piece of legislation?
I think it depends on how well informed a person is. If somebody has the attitude, I'm not going to pay any attention to this, they're all crooks, you know, heck with them, you probably won't be able to convince that person that there's an honest effort to try and remedy these ills. On the other hand, if it's someone who follows government and says, yeah, this is a problem, and I'm glad to see the lawmakers addressing it, albeit it takes kind of a crisis to get them off the dime, then I think they will respond. And I know in my case, I look back at the history of every piece of ethics reform that has occurred in the General Assembly has always been in response to some crisis that made it, what would you say, more politically uncomfortable for the legislators to do nothing than for them to act. So I would expect we're very likely to see, for example, a ban on lobbying for pay by members of the General Assembly. I'd also like to see, and this is a recommendation that's been made by legislative inspector generals for the last 10, 12 years, that the legislature has stricter economic disclosure rules, akin to what the Supreme Court has for justices and judges throughout the state. Those would be good steps, I think.
You know, it's interesting to hear Charlie talking about some of the, you know, crises that have led to ethics law changes in the past. And I think about, you know, for the three of us, not counting Jamie, who works for the Chicago Tribune, a private company, but three of us who work or have worked for the University of Illinois, we all have to do annual ethics training, like most anyone who works for state government. Governor Blagojevich was corrupt, and the result of that, or maybe it was even Governor Ryan who was corrupt, the result of that is thousands and thousands of people have to take this ethics training, much of which, I will say, has very little bearing on my job. I don't really do procurement or anything like that in my job as a State House reporter, yet I have to, you know, learn and understand about what those rules are in the law. So I wonder how many of those ethics changes that Charlie has seen had that, you know, direct bearing on the wrongdoing, or it's like, well, we need to look like we're doing something, much like I was talking about, you know, now we're talking about targeting lobbyists, or at least the governor's talking about targeting lobbyists, while, meanwhile, by definition, Representative Arroyo was arrested and accused of a federal crime that's already on the books called bribery.
Well, and Brian and Charlie, I'll let you weigh in on that, but I also would add to the fact that a lot of times legislation is passed after some event, you know, very reactive type of legislation that ends up creating more problems for people. And I would say some of the procurement laws, and I think many people in higher education would back me up on this, have become pretty onerous and make it difficult to get things done at times because somebody else did something wrong.
Yeah, I think the danger is in overreacting. And I guess to get to a philosophical point of view, the bad guys are always going to try and figure out a way around the laws or the rules. The good people, moral, ethical people, don't need those kind of rules. So you're reacting to the bad apples, and sometimes it causes problems for everybody else. But I go back to one of the very first things I covered for the Chicago Sun-Times was the Constitutional Convention way back in 1970. And one of the additions to the new Constitution, it was new back then, replacing the one from 1870, was a requirement for economic disclosure. That was brought about because of a circumstance in which a couple of Supreme Court justices were receiving bank stock through an intermediary from a guy who had a case pending before the court. They wound up resigning. And as I say, the response was, well, we need more economic disclosure. And so that became part of the Constitution.
That's Charlie Wheeler, an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Joining him on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were moderator Sean Crawford, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, and reporter Jamie Monks from the Chicago Tribune. On the next TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10, host Guy Raz talks with TED speakers about hiding parts of who they really are. Find out what it's like to hide behind a disguise, name, or belief to try to expose and explain the truth around the world and us. That's on the next TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10 on 89.1 and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A big barrier to widespread adoption of all electric vehicles is doubt about how far you can go, how long it will take to charge up, and where to find a charging station. Illinois and Iowa will work together with four other states to study the availability of alternative fuel along Interstate 80. They've received a federal grant and will each contribute some of their own money to figure out where electric vehicles can be charged and where compressed natural gas is available.
From coast to coast, Interstate 80 is 2,900 miles long. The eastern half, known as the Mid-America Corridor, goes from New Jersey through Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois to the western border of Iowa, 163 miles in Illinois and 306 miles in Iowa. Christopher Schmidt, air quality manager for the Illinois Department of Transportation, says they want to find out where alternative fuel is available. Because right now, drivers of these vehicles often suffer from something called range anxiety.
So that's a real phrase, yeah. Range anxiety, through a lot of national studies, ends up being one of the top five, if not top three, reasons why somebody wouldn't purchase an electric vehicle or, let's say, alternative fuel vehicle. So the idea with this project is to make those gaps disappear. In Illinois, we're in pretty good shape. You could travel from the Quad Cities to the Indiana border fairly easy an electric vehicle with proper infrastructure along the way, depending on what level of charge you started out the trip with and what level you wanted to enter Indiana with.
Stu Anderson works for the Iowa Department of Transportation as the director of the Planning, Programming, and Modal Division. He says the range of the current early-generation electric vehicles often depends on the temperature and the wind.
We have some charging infrastructure, which is called Level 2, chargers, which charge at a slower rate and take longer to charge. But then what really we need on these corridors for long distance travel are these called DC fast charging stations, direct current fast charging stations, which do a really high charge in a short period of time.
Iowa currently has just three of the DC-3 or fast charge stations in Council Bluffs, Des Moines, and Coralville. And Tesla has some stations for its own vehicles.
So what this planning effort will do is really try to identify the ideal location to fill in gaps and also help identify partnerships to get those facilities developed.
Schmidt says to be considered available for drivers on I-80, alternative fuel stations must be located within 5 miles of the interstate.
We were just in a conference in Detroit with a lot of the regional states, and the concept basically now is there's really no bad place to put EV charging. You know, it's needed everywhere, and you're going to see demand as long as it's connected to an interstate.
Anderson cautions, though, that the cost of connecting with the appropriate electrical service to fast-charge electric vehicles can be very expensive.
And of course, it's more than just the charging infrastructure. These sites also need to have amenities for the public, some sort of shelter, restroom facilities, adequate lighting. Ideally, there's some like restaurant or food availability as well. So that all comes into the discussion as well.
And those three fast charge sites in Iowa, two of them are located at gas stations, while the third is in the parking lot of a Walmart store. Schmidt says this is a unique opportunity for the six states along I-80.
One thing that I'd emphasize with everybody, you know, when you hear about autonomous vehicles and that revolution is coming, there's not a lot of manufacturers that are creating those vehicles with gas-powered engines. It doesn't make a lot of sense to take gasoline energy, convert it to electric, and have it run all those sensors and all the things that are needed. Those vehicles are going to run on an electric engine and eventually hydrogen converted to electric. So that's where we're headed.
The multi-state collaboration includes the Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois, U.S. Department of Energy, and Trillium, a company based in Oklahoma that develops and installs alternative fuel systems. It's a division of the Loves Company, which owns truck stops and stores in 41 states. I'm Herb Trix.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock, Ryan Denham, and Edith Brady Lunny. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.